On the last issue of this series, we experimented with a new case-based approach to education in which faculty members present real but de-identified cases from their practices. Part B of that experiment is on this issue and includes a roundtable discussion with Dr. Shablowsky and Drs. Mara Dickler and Dr. Muhammad Jahanzeb. Dr. Shablowsky began by presenting a patient facing perhaps the most discussed transition point in breast cancer therapy, the 5-year mark after having received an adjuvant aromatase inhibitor.
60-year-old white female diagnosed on mammogram to have a 2.1-centimeter tumor, ER positive, PR positive, HER2 negative, intermediate grade, infiltrating ductal carcinoma, 2 nodes positive after sentinel and then axillary dissection, lumpectomy plus radiation therapy. So 2.1 centimeter, 2 nodes positive, refused chemotherapy, has completed 5 years of aromatase inhibitor.
Can you talk a little bit more about the woman herself and why she refused? You had recommended chemo to her, obviously.
Yeah, and so she had a relative who had a difficult time with chemotherapy. It was lung cancer. It was one of those same things that happened to me if I take the chemotherapy. And she was involved in this brother-in-law's care.
What was this woman's particular concern about chemo? Did she verbalize that to you?
It really was watching a typical non-small cell lung cancer terminal course, and she attributed that course to chemotherapy.
Interesting.
So it had this link that wasn't possible to break.
So she got treated again with?
With aromatase inhibitor.
And then she got out to 5 years?
So she's out to 5 years now. And say what her circumstance were, she really kind of did well on the aromatase inhibitor, so no arthralgias or increase in arthralgias. She had baseline arthralgias. I asked everyone, do they have joint pain? Yes, no. And then make them say mild, moderate, severe, and has it changed since the last visit? Do you have joint swelling? Yes, no. Mild, moderate, severe, has it changed the last visit? And so I have actually a quantitative feel for what has happened with, you know, in 2 seconds. And she had mild joint pain, no swelling, and it hadn't changed. And she was not on a bisphosphonate yet. Her T-score was minus 1.5. She had no history of cardiovascular disease, but she had controlled hypertension that was under treatment.
Now, her T-score, had that changed since she got treated?
It was close to normal, and it drifted down to minus 1.5.
So you got into the question of, are you going to continue the AI?
Yeah, so the question was, should we stop or continue the aromatase inhibitor?
And, of course, she might have been eligible for the new NSABP trial, but we'll talk about it sort of outside of that. Did she have any kind of feeling herself about what she wanted to do?
In retrospect, she was missing not taking the chemotherapy in a certain sense. I think she kind of had some second thoughts about it and thought that she was a little bit behind. I know many of my patients, when I presented them the MA17 data when it came out, which I did as a routine visit, I didn't call the people in. When they came in, almost everybody who had been over a year from therapy said, I like coming, parking, chatting with you. It's a lot of fun, but I'm done with my breast cancer and I don't want to take it. So she was a little bit unusual in that regard. I'm getting her right at the 5-year period, but at a time when she had still had a little bit of guilt for not taking the chemotherapy.
What are you generally doing with people who had 5 years of an AI?
Yeah, what I'll do is when I start people on an AI now, I'll tell them that I plan to give it for at least 7 years and explain about the lack of data for it and the safety concerns. And I said we might have more data on duration as time goes on. I do that up front because a fair number, and I don't know exactly what the number is, people who get to 5 years and you tell them I want to continue are into that I'm done with my cancer kind of business. And of course, it gets back to the adherence. These longer regimens, there's 2 things about the adherence. So our just had a review that will be published in about a month in Oncology, Karger, looking at tamoxifen adherence, you know, with the 3 population-based studies and Partridge's and others, where it looks like 30 to 50% of women are stopping their tamoxifen between the 4th and 5th year. And Dr. Partridge had a study looking at about the same kind of results with aromatase inhibitors this year at San Antonio. Not many oncologists believe that. Maybe up to half of the women aren't taking the medication in the 4th year. So in a certain sense, it's a little interesting when we talk about longer duration if half the people are taking a shorter duration volitionally. So anyway, I would tell people I'm favoring a longer duration to hope that they would take it, recognize that there isn't safety data now.
And you favor it more in higher-risk patients or not necessarily?
Yeah, and I think it's almost because of the uncertainty and I'd like to have a bigger target for efficacy in that population.
MJ, what are your thoughts in terms of how you approach the patient who's had 5 years and what do you think about this compliance or adherence data suggesting that a lot of people don't take their medicine?
I think that's an excellent practical issue. First of all, to answer the first part of the question, at 5 years of tamoxifen, it's easy. I fall back on the MA17 extension and offer them an AI and talk about it. at 5 years of AI, I'm only left with telling them the risk continues and something ought to be done. I don't know what that something is. If they are tolerating it, fine. If they are able to afford it and they want to continue to take it, again, like Rowan, I say, continue to take it, but I'm not telling them 2 years because I don't really know what the duration is. I'm hoping that within 2 years, in the back of my mind, there'll be more snippets here and there, and then I'll update the recommendation, but I don't tell them up front. I say, take it for now as more data are emerging. That's what I tell them right now. As for compliance, you know, those people are not going to take whatever else I recommend. So I talk to them more about compliance. And
do you think that is an issue?
I don't think half. Half maybe in my patient population, it may be an overestimate, but patient populations vary and we don't keep rigorous numbers. So I don't know exactly what that is. My gestalt, my gut feeling is that it's not half. I would say maybe about a fourth of patients don't take it religiously, rigorously. Sometimes, you know, anything that happens, they attribute it to their pill. If it's joint pain or depression, even palpitations, dyspepsia, whatever it is, they say, well, when I stopped taking it, I got better. So then you have to talk them out of it, that it may be an association. The other issue that I look at, which again, without much data, but with some gut feeling, those who are strongly ERPR positive, very ER rich, in those patients, I'm more emphatic about asking them to continue to take it. In the back of my mind, I think they're luminal A subtype. But if those who are weakly positive, I'm not that particular about it. I generally make that differentiation. I don't know if anybody else does to that extent.
Maura, how are you approaching these patients in 5 years?
I think in a similar way I struggle, and I do tell women up front it will be 5 years, but then I hope that we'll have more data. And in practicing on the Upper East Side of New York, patients are actually coming to me and saying, what are you going to do with me after 5 years? And I say, I think that's an excellent question, and we'll see when we get there. But I definitely opt for continuing therapy, particularly my high-risk patients. If we know letrozole extends the benefits of 5 years of tamoxifen and I'm at the five-year junction, I feel like I want to protect them year five through possibly 10 after I finish an AI for 5 years. And at the present time for this patient who had positive nodes, I would offer her continued AI therapy, watch her bone density closely, and sort of take it on a year-by-year basis. I also wonder about whether switching to tamoxifen is going to be the way, and I'm anxiously awaiting the results of BIG-198 in terms of the sequencing strategy, because there's a part of me that thinks that switching after several years from one mechanism of action to another may potentially be the best way to do it. And I sometimes wonder, is it going to be 5 years of an AI and 5 years of tamoxifen, where you give your best drug up front? But I don't think any studies are looking at that sequence right now in the five-year blocks.
Yeah, because BIG-198 is switching within that five-year time frame.
Right, two and a half.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder, you know, if the letrozole to TAM arm is better, how that will shape up what I do in 5 years. I don't know.
Yes, another point that I think is important is that some people will recommend starting tamoxifen first so they can give 7 years of therapy. And I don't particularly find that attractive because I say there's the same lack of data for that strategy as there is for 7 years of AI. And then you're spotting the people the first couple of years of recurrences and giving the double toxicity without knowing you have benefit. So I don't think that's a reason. You don't need to give tamoxifen first to give more than 5 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy, in my book, as I look at the evidence.
Why don't we go on to your case, MJ?
Well, the patient I was going to present is a 64-year-old white female who had trauma to left breast in August of 2005 and had some pain and nipple retraction, got worried, had a left mammogram and ultrasound in August of that year, had a complex mass in the left upper outer quadrant, had a core needle biopsy, which was negative, just showed fibrocystic changes, and was reassured that maybe it's due to hematoma, some traumatic changes, fibrosis, etc. She had more pain in January and was very worried, so the surgeon took her to the OR for an incisional biopsy, which on frozen section looked positive, did a sentinel node procedure, which also showed a positive node, so her procedure was extended to modified radical mastectomy, which had been discussed with her ahead of time that that's a possibility. So final path showed a T2 tumor, 2.5 centimeters, and she had 10 positive nodes out of the 12 sampled. ERPR positive, HER2 was negative, and she also had DCIS in the specimen, margins were negative. Her staging workup was negative for Mets. Ejection fraction came back at 51%, so borderline low, where it becomes relevant to look at her past history, which has hypertension, diabetes, coronary artery disease. She has had two CABGs, one in 1995 and one in 2001. History of congestive heart failure. although at this time rejection fraction wasn't really low enough to explain any current imminent congestive heart failure. She has question of sleep apnea.
Can you talk a little bit more about the woman herself? What was her condition? She sounds sort of sick, but is that the way she appeared?
She is one of those anxious women, very anxious, a lot of anxiety, and otherwise her medical problems, although numerous, were under control. I mean, her last CABG was 4 years ago, no recent angina, blood pressure was controlled, diabetes was controlled. So she was fully functional otherwise.
Did she have any resentment or concerns about the fact that this had not been diagnosed previously?
Some, but not a whole lot because its biopsy was done. I mean, whatever could be done at the time was done. It's not like people just reassured her and didn't do anything about it. But that wasn't something she dwelled on.
So, Mara, it's a difficult situation. 10 positive no's and yet this history of CHF. What do you think you might have done?
It's a very difficult case because she's not that old, 64, but significant comorbidity, both from cardiovascular disease and also her breast cancer. And how do you balance these two? These cases are a little bit easier when that patient is sitting in front of you because seeing what she looks like and sort of her take on things, I think, is very important. You know, I think that use of an anthracycline is not absolutely contraindicated in this setting, but I think this is a good case to consider the use of cyclophosphamide and taxotere. But I think I would talk to her about dose-dense ACT as well as CT. And then, you know, for patients who are very risk-averse, who I feel I want to give chemotherapy, I even still bring CMF into the mix. And it's something that is better tolerated in general and probably can get her through it. And I would talk with her about each regimen and the potential benefits. I could use adjuvant online. I find that very effective because it gives patients some sort of objective data on which they can base their decisions. And then in this case, I would decide with her, but I do think that CT is something I would definitely speak of to this patient where I could at least give a taxane. It's short therapy and it's safer than AC.
You would consider using an anthracycline in this patient?
She's got an ejection fraction of 51%. You can follow her closely. You could get a MUGA scan after 2 cycles. I think that it's something that you could watch very closely. It's her other comorbidities that worry me equally. You know, I think that AC can be a tough regimen. We give steroids for antiemetics. She's a diabetic. All of those things. Although with CT, you do the same. And that's why, you know, CMF I bring into the mix because often people can be relatively symptom-free, and I think it's less stressful, and you don't need as much steroids in terms of the antiemetics as well. But yeah, I wouldn't rule it out because 10 positive nodes is pretty significant risk. This is someone who I would do an evidence of disease evaluation. I would do a CAT scan and bone scan because if I did find any evidence of distant metastatic disease, I would offer her hormonal therapy and it would very much change her treatment and I could save her the morbidity of chemotherapy.
And she had all those scans and she, of course, was...
There's a couple things. One would be, I like the concept of TC and we've been using it. And this is the kind of thing where, again, with some chatting, with the high-risk regimen, I might go to 6 instead of 4 until no data. But
you know, 6 cycles.
6 cycles, you know, being evaluated AC, and why not consider that? It's interesting. I mean, some people talk about San Antonio not having much, but I think it really had a lot this year. And I just think about our standard therapies that we're talking about. When you talk about anthracyclines, between the BCRG suggestion that maybe anthracyclines aren't going to be needed in the HER2 overexpressing patients, which seemed almost unbelievable 18 months ago, and then the meta-analysis of the HER2 overexpression trials looking at anthracycline efficacy, where it looked like, again, we're looking at all comers, that the efficacy was limited to the HER2 overexpressors compared to CMF, like regimens. So it leaves it, if you're not using the HER2 overexpressors and that's the only place it works, then where do you need it? I mean, that was the argument a little bit, though not in such a formal fashion that Dr. Slayman made. And then I get the CMF, where we had the CMF kind of small randomized trial, CMF versus 2 doses of capecitabine. And capecitabine had a survival benefit over CMF in advanced disease. And so one could question those being all definitive results. You got a meta-analysis of published data. You've got 2-year follow-up of BCRG. You got a small randomized phase 3. But if those things hold up, where would you use Adriamycin or where would you use CMF compared to non-Adriamycin-containing regimens or capecitabine regimens? So, and I find that very puzzling because I'm looking at some of the regimens that I'm giving and I'm saying, is this going to be the best thing? I haven't really changed everything that I'm doing, but this is the first year I've really had this strong signal that things might really be moving in a different direction. I would offer this patient TC and tell her that I think maybe we need a couple extra cycles. Obviously, that's a great need. We don't have 10 nodes positive, one node positive, there isn't anything else to give her, right? I mean, in terms of high-risk regimen, that used to be a big growth industry, and now there isn't much to do with these higher-risk people.
So what happened with this lady?
Well, exactly along those lines, we talked to her, we've talked about CMF, we felt that it wasn't considered by most U.S. oncologists adequate therapy for this type of situation. And we talked about TC, and we talked about the lesser used and with less data, CMF followed by Taxotere for three cycles, and ultimately decided on TC, and again, without any data, we told her that we believe that four cycles are not enough, and maybe she should have six cycles, just like you were suggesting.
Great minds think alike.
Just a hunch. Yeah. She got five cycles and begged for mercy and never received six cycles.
What happened during the treatment?
Well, I mean, she got steroids, which made diabetes management difficult with every cycle, and she got progressive fatigue, tiredness, just no energy. And she said, you know, do I really have to? When there's no data, you are less trigger happy and more gun shy. And we told her, well, we can't really tell you whether there's a difference between five and six cycles. And if this is how you feel, then let's call it a day and send you for radiation therapy. So that's what we did.
Mara, would there ever be a role of using nanoparticle paclitaxel in the adjuvant setting, a patient who you either think or maybe you're starting to see a lot of problems with steroids?
Yes, I feel that there is a small trial done by U.S. Oncology looking at Abraxane in the adjuvant setting. And we're doing a pilot study looking at bevacizumab in combination with dose-dense AC Abraxane. So as I'm giving it more at 260 per meter Q2 without the steroids, I think that it's an option. However, I do think that there's more neuropathy, and diabetics are the patients that really get neuropathy from the taxanes, and they're the ones who come back years later and they still have it. So,
is that a clinical impression, or are there data that support that?
It's my clinical impression that, I mean, and I give taxanes to diabetics, but I notice that they get it and have it for longer, and I just think that they're susceptible to peripheral neuropathy, but I haven't seen any data for that.
Either of you two seen it? I mean, it kind of makes sense, but...
Anecdotally, yes.
And that's always a little bit of a balance in the weekly reports. If you have a longer time to progression than the way the data is reported, then is that going to be just that? The other question is persistence. I guess that's the question, is that the suggestion is that the Abraxane induced without the chromophore is less persistent, though I'm not sure if that's true or not. Back to that same question, we had exactly the same thing. We had a patient who was getting first cycle of Taxotere, 100, and she was adjuvant, and she was in bed for 10 days, and then kind of crawls back for the second week, and you got a bunch more to go.
Based on what, fatigue? Or?
Yeah, it's pretty much fatigue. And when you look at the randomized trial, where it was 30% grade 2-3 fatigue for Taxotere 100, and it was 9% for nab-paclitaxel, would be something to consider. I didn't do it, but it's really interesting if she has trouble again the next time, rather than saying, well, we're done, or you're going to have to slug it out for two more cycles, then maybe that would be something I would consider.
You said you've been using TC, and the initial reaction that I saw in oncologists, even though it was reported to be better tolerated than the AC, was skepticism about that. Is that what you're observing, that it is better tolerated in AC, the same or worse?
Yeah, I think it's about the same, maybe a little better. I don't have too much difficulty with it. I mean, taxanes can be difficult for anybody, especially the Taxotere, in terms of taking it serially. But we've been pretty happy with our ability to deliver TC.
I find Taxotere 100 single agent more difficult than TC because Taxotere is at 75.
I agree. I've had some very good experience with TC. I think it's better tolerated in general than AC, but I just had somebody who had got a first cycle and had a young person, lots of arthralgias. So, you know, but this was the first one where I started thinking, boy, this is really easy. And then I had someone else, some trouble.
What specifically is the differentiating between TC and AC in terms of just the general tolerated better or anything in specific?
Well, when I have more high-risk node negative, where I sometimes discuss ACT, but I don't feel as strongly, and I say I have sort of a middle-of-the-road TC where there is less cardiac toxicity, patients like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they're comforted by that. And I don't give much AC for four cycles anymore, and that if TC has an improved disease-free survival and none of the risk for congestive heart failure, my bias is to use TC instead of AC.
So. Biggest immediate piece, I think you would agree, is the difference in nausea and vomiting.
Is that what you say, Mara?
Yeah.
Yeah, and people have done very well.
Okay, why don't we go into one of your cases?
This is a 48-year-old woman of Ashkenazi Jewish descent whose mother had a history of bilateral breast cancer, but it was postmenopausal. And she was found to have calcifications on a routine screening mammogram. And she had a mastectomy on the left side and had DCIS only. And she opted to remove her right breast, and an incidental focus of invasive lobular carcinoma was found at that time. And that was estrogen and progesterone receptor positive. And that was in 98. And they went on to do a full right axillary lymph node dissection, which was negative. And she had no adjuvant chemotherapy at that time. In June of 2001, she had rising markers, and a CAT scan showed...
Sorry, no adjuvant hormonal therapy either?
No.
No adjuvant therapy. Okay.
No, and I inherited her several years later, but it was just a microscopic focus of invasive lobular carcinoma. And in 98, remember, that was around when the prevention P1 trial was being reported, and that's when we started giving tamoxifen very liberally. So,
and then the first breast, though, what did it do?
The left breast was just DCIS, okay. And that was found mammographically, but because she was Ashkenazi Jewish with this strong family history of breast cancer, she opted for prophylactic, and it was in the prophylactic mastectomy that the small focus of cancer was seen.
And how large was it, or small was it?
Single microscopic focus of invasive lobular. That's all I have.
So what was the next point?
So in June of 2001, she had rising markers, and a CAT scan showed multiple low attenuation lesions in the liver, the largest 6.7 centimeters.
So you routinely follow markers on such patients?
Yes, we do. She actually wasn't my patient then, but they did also. She was cared for by a physician across the street, but they were. And we do have clinical trials for patients who have no evidence of disease but rising tumor markers. We have some vaccine trials, so we do screen our patients for that. I realize the ASCO guidelines do not support it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you get discrepancies, and I don't do markers either, though I can understand why people would like to do it. I think one of the benefits is if you tell the patient there's something that they might have recurrence, then it sounds like you're on the case. And it's just that you get occasionally there will be a upset husband who will say, why wasn't this found, and feel that a CT scan or bone scan is somehow protective. But I don't routinely do them. And you really do have a couple schools of thought on the way to approach this.
We do have clinical trials where these women would become eligible. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's at least I have something to offer, because sometimes you have patients who have rising markers and there is no active disease.
You can't find anything.
Yeah.
Have you seen any responses, incidentally? You know, marker responses in any of these trials?
The primary endpoint of these vaccine studies are just to assess immunologic response. And Terry Gillespie is the PI on those studies. This patient got various, she had a biopsy of her liver, which I think is very appropriate given this setting, and it was consistent with adenocarcinoma of breast primary, which is really incredible since she had this sort of occult, incidentally found invasive lobular, and she was ERPR positive and HER2 negative. This is now a woman who's first line with metastatic disease in the liver. When all of this was going on, she was about 44.
So she was premenopausal?
She was still menstruating.
Still actively menstruating at that point.
Yes.
Okay, Rowan, so we've got a lady who's got liver mets, ER positive, HER2 negative, asymptomatic from the tumor, it sounds like.
Asymptomatic from the tumor, yes.
What do you think you might have done?
And how old is she?
44 and still menstruating.
44 and still menstruating. You have a whole range of, and liver function's okay.
Liver function is okay.
I mean, you have a whole range of options, and this is one where I'm almost reactive with the patient. You know, in a non-protocol setting, you can go from the minimalist thing, you could just give her tamoxifen, to saying, I'm going to give you combination chemotherapy, trying to get a higher response frequency, and then maybe switch you to hormone therapy. I think the tricky part in somebody like this that's young is trying to explain what the business at hand is. And I was thinking about this basketball coach that's now coaching and had recurrent disease, and her oncologist is in the USA Today saying that she's just treated for palliation, which seems a little bit goofy unless she said it was okay. But, and then this is this young woman who's coaching her college basketball team now, you know, 2 months after being diagnosed with, I presume, to be metastatic cancer. So I think the important thing is to try to figure out how this person views their life with this condition. Do they want to aggressively attack it? Because I don't know a strategy which would be better or not better for them. I think a number of us have biases as to how it will be better. And some of us would feel strongly that you want to give chemotherapy, reduce the tumor burden, and then do something else as opposed to, or you can say that the first regimen you start somebody off, and this is my more guiding principle, the first regimen you start somebody off is going to be the one they're going to be on longest, most often. So in that case, you could either use tamoxifen or capecitabine as an initial therapy and say, and you could be on it for a long time. In a 44-year-old, even with advanced disease, where we know that at least that small randomized trial, ovarian suppression with GnRH analogs plus tamoxifen has survival advantage over either alone. Again, that would be something to discuss with somebody if they want to see how they're doing with menopausal symptoms. So I would explain my philosophy of saying that about this longest duration therapy on first and see if how they view about taking this kind of not so aggressive approach to their tumor, recognizing they're in for the intermediate haul, and it might be years and years the way things are going now. But I think talking to somebody at this age, they're very likely to come back and say, I want to be as aggressive as possible. And then I would go with the combination kind of chemotherapy regimen.
What specific one?
The thing that we've been using would be capecitabine and Taxotere.
MJ, how would you think this through?
I like to get a handle of velocity of disease, which I think is critical. As you know, because of our biases, not because of any randomized data, younger patients, larger tumor burden, rapidly progressive disease, tend to get combination chemotherapy, even if they're ERP are positive. We chicken out and we just start with chemotherapy, especially if they are visceral metastasis. And I think that's appropriate if there's visceral crisis going on. In this lady, although the metastasis is large, you know that she has not had her breast for 4 years. So at least it took 4 years for this to develop in her liver. And that would tell me that I can gamble on the side of being conservative and say maybe this has not been so fast. It's large, but it took it a while to get large. And first try just tamoxifen. My philosophy usually in metastatic disease is to do as little as possible for as long as possible. So start with tamoxifen, keeping a close eye, evaluating her sooner rather than later for rapid progression. You know, I wouldn't expect tamoxifen to work before an average of 4 months, but this type of patient I would reevaluate within 8 weeks to see if she's not rapidly progressing.
Just out of curiosity, let's say she had a good response to tamoxifen and then progressed, then what?
If that happens, I'm now thinking in my mind, I'm 14 months out from this situation already. And if she responded and then progressed, I caught that progression early and she's not even attained her baseline of 6.7. So then I would at that time do ovarian suppression with aromatase inhibitor in this type of patient.
Responds to that and then progresses.
And then third line, one could think of fulvestrant at that time. I'd like to exhaust all...
With ovarian suppression on board?
Yeah, because the data is in postmenopausal women. So I would like to maximize the benefit of squeeze out all the benefit from hormonal therapy and then switch to sequential single agents for chemo. And I'd like to start with non-alopecia producing and less toxic single agents first, and then go to the alopecia producing or more toxic single agents, and then to combination if one has to.
So what happened with this lady?
So she got various opinions really reflecting the options that she has at hand. I know one opinion was for ovarian suppression and letrozole, and another opinion was for combination chemotherapy. And she opted to do combination chemotherapy, and she got doxorubicin in combination with docetaxel.
And was that followed by hormone therapy, or did she just got the chemo?
She got that for 6 cycles, and she had a tremendous response initially to that. And after 6 cycles with a good response, she was given Lupron and put on tamoxifen.
Now, were you taking care of her at that point?
No.
Okay, so this all happened before. Okay, so she ended up getting pretty significant therapy, but having a good response.
Right.
Then what was the next step?
She really had a very short-lived time on the tamoxifen. Within several weeks, she had progression of disease in her liver.
Okay, so before we talk about the clinical trial, you see this patient, Rowan, as a second opinion, and that's the story. She had a great response to chemo, really not much of a response to tamoxifen. And at that point, was she, again, symptomatic from her tumor?
Yes, and I actually think initially she had had a very enlarged liver with this 6.7 centimeters. So I don't think that she was sick, but I think that she did have significant liver mets with a palpable liver.
And her liver came back down again when she progressed?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, so I don't think there's too much data that I can find that tells me how quickly somebody progresses on a hormone therapy determines whether they're going to respond or not, you know, to further hormone therapy. It looks like from at least the limited data we have from randomized trials that maybe 30 to 40% of patients have a clinical benefit to a second hormonal agent.
Even when they walk through the first one?
Well, I think there isn't good data. I guess the question is going to be, one would think that if you have resistance and come right through it, that you would do worse. But there isn't great data. But having said that, probably in somebody like this, when you have capecitabine available, if she hadn't had it before, I probably would give her that. I mean, the option would be, again, as we're talking about, the aromatase inhibitors still kind of available. But I think somebody that walked right through tamoxifen, I probably would go to capecitabine second.
What about bevacizumab?
Yeah. It is interesting that in my practice, if we're not using it first, we have a difficult time using it in this public hospital setting. And so basically, if I don't use it, you know, kind of first line, then I will have difficulty kind of using it. That would be a reasonable thing to use. I think it's reasonable to use it not only first line, but subsequently. But it is interesting that you kind of have to think of it in breast cancer as opposed to some other diseases, because you can go pretty far along. I mean, we've been discussing things for a long time before we got to bevacizumab. So it's pretty easy to go three cycles downstream and say, oh, how about bevacizumab?
So you're saying in terms of paying or acquiring the drug, it's a problem in your setting, but let's just put that aside.
Well, I don't mean just only that. It's just that we have other alternatives.
But in general, even if you have had access to it easily, you still would be thinking about not using to use capecitabine?
So the two combinations, there would be Taxol plus bevacizumab, which was active in people who had prior at least adjuvant taxane. The 160 patients in that randomized trial had about the same time to progression benefit. This is taxane in advanced disease, which is a little bit different because that would have been just a few months before probably that she had that. You could use bevacizumab with other agents. So
what about capecitabine and bevacizumab?
Yeah, that's a reasonable combination. And that's something that could be considered in this kind of patient.
MJ?
Assuming that we have the knowledge that she got Taxotere before, I would be a little bit later using capecitabine bevacizumab because that particular trial was negative. So she had both anthracycline and taxane, and those patients did not seem to benefit in the Kathy Miller study of bevacizumab.
So what do you think you might have done with her?
At the point of progression or no?
At the point of progression, yeah.
At the point of progression, I would have, knowing that she had received anthracycline and taxane, followed the evidence to just try capecitabine next.
So what happened?
I present this case because I have learned so much from this case over many years. She was offered participation in that negative trial of capecitabine with or without bevacizumab, because this was in 2001, and she was randomized to receive capecitabine plus bevacizumab at the end of 2001. It's now 2007, and she's still on that therapy.
Wow.
That's a great case.
She had really a partial response in terms of scans, in that her liver never completely normalized, but essentially, recently she got a PET scan, and there's no uptake in the liver, and I think that she's essentially had as much of a complete response and is in remission as any patient I've ever taken care of. This is a little unusual. But I bring it up because now she has always had pretty significant hand-foot syndrome. I mean, you can't be on capecitabine this long, has had numerous dose reductions. And as a matter of fact, she completely manages her capecitabine dosing. She ultimately was on 2 in the morning, 2 at night, alternating weeks for many years, and would drop a dose here and there, give herself an additional break as needed. But she also developed about 2 years ago significant hypertension and proteinuria. And her proteinuria has ranged from 1 up to 3.5 grams. She has never had nephrotic syndrome, but she has had changes in her lipid profile as well.
What have you been doing about the hypertension?
She is managed on 3 medications. She has been on beta blockers, ACE inhibitor, and calcium channel blockers. And with the proteinuria, she's been very closely followed by one of our nephrologists. And the way we've managed that is by at times giving her a break from the bevacizumab, and the proteinuria comes down, and relatively quickly, in a couple of weeks, we can get it into the 1 gram range. And also, at times, we've lowered her dose because, as you know, in colorectal cancer, they use 5 mg/kg every other week. In this trial, it was 15 mg/kg every 3 weeks. So I felt comfortable at times reducing her dose as well. But more recently, she's developed some chest heaviness that's been extensively worked up. And although we're really unsure nature of the etiology, she thinks it's the capecitabine. Since we have no definite evidence of disease, and I think she's having a lot of toxicity from the Xeloda at this juncture, and we're maintaining her on bevacizumab, but in a somewhat non-traditional way, I've just offered her letrozole, and we've stopped the capecitabine.
What about the Bev?
We have a feasibility study where we've enrolled 43 patients with letrozole plus bevacizumab. So although she's not part of this trial, it's proven safe, and we are in the late phases of a design of a randomized trial in the CLGB looking at endocrine therapy with or without bevacizumab. So I probably will continue the bevacizumab, but really closely watching her proteinuria. But this is somebody who's been on anti-angiogenic therapy since 2001, and she always loves to say this was a negative trial, because for her, this was really quite a success. And I think we're all a little reluctant to stop that anti-VEGF therapy.
It's an interesting analogy, the colorectal cancer area, when you go across the hall, and where they have the stop-and-go strategy seems to be for everything, you know, for all the regimens. That was the ASCO last year. There was a whole number of things where they give for a period of time, stop with some of these same agents, and then seem to be able to show that they don't lose anything by stopping until progression occurs. And, of course, they're doing that all the time now, and we're doing that pretty much not at all.
Well, it's interesting. They are doing that. Just last Saturday was the ASCO GI meeting, and without going into great detail, and actually your colleague, Maura Lentz-Saltz, presented some interesting data. Some people stop everything, and other people just stop like the oxaliplatin or the irinotecan and keep the Bev and the 5-FU going. And he actually presented some findings to suggest that maybe people do better if you keep the Bev and the 5-FU going and, you know, just get rid of the offending agent. But I guess we don't really know the answer. What an incredible case.
Yeah, and, you know, whether we should really be stopping the capecitabine or not, it's we're unclear. The only thing that ultimately pushed us, because she has been on it a long time, is she really feels that her quality of life has now been affected. And I never make a decision and tell this patient what to do. It's very much a group decision, because she had to feel comfortable doing this.
What about just going down lower on the capecitabine?
Well, we really have. And sometimes she says that she's even dropped to 1-1. I mean, she really has managed this for so many years, but her hands are so leathery. But actually, it was never the hands that really bothered her. It was now this feeling that she has in her chest, and she's had echoes, stress tests. It's unclear whether she's having vasospasm. I don't think it's ischemic. I don't think it's
reflux.
Did
it go away when you stopped the capecitabine?
Yes, it
really?
Has.
Wow.
Yeah. But she's also, remember, we had stopped the bevacizumab also, but we've now reintroduced the bevacizumab, and we'll see, and I'll watch her closely, and I'm possibly not done with the capecitabine. This, he just started the letrozole.
Interesting. Rowan, you want to present another case?
This is a short one, but an interesting kind of question kind of just came up. This is a 50-year-old woman who presented with a 2-centimeter tumor, kind of diagnosed lumpectomy, ER positive, PR positive, HER2 negative, intermediate grade infiltrating ductal cancer. One lymph node positive, was treated with TAC times 6. She had no menses for 6 months prior to diagnosis, so that would have been when she's 49. Began on tamoxifen, and now was seen, 3 weeks ago, in now completed 2 years of tamoxifen therapy, is now 52 years of age, no menses in the past 30 months. Presented to me as whether she should be switched to an AI or not, and has no risk factors at this young age that would move you to do it on the basis of heart disease or any other comorbidities.
And her chemical profile in terms of menopause?
I don't send it, so
you don't do it.
I don't do it. So that gives you kind of an idea of where I'm going with this case, yeah.
Okay. MJ, how would you have thought through it?
I would have sent the profile. I'd do it and then felt comfortable, because I've had patients who after chemo, 3 years after chemo, have had resumption of their ovarian function, and that scares me. So not only would I have sent it, I would have repeated it 6 months later. So that's what I do.
And then you would have put her on an AI?
If she was menopausal, I would have talked about it, but tried to talk her into staying on for 5, maximizing the benefit, then taking an AI for 5 along MA17 lines.
So you think you would have let her go out to 5 years with tamoxifen?
Yes.
Maura?
I also feel similarly cautious about sequencing these people too early, because I have found that some people can have resumption of ovarian function later than you think. I suspect this woman's menopausal, but I would have checked many estradiol levels over time and then given it some. But I think chances are you could probably sequence her at this juncture. And I think with TAC chemotherapy for 6 cycles, I think most people are made amenorrheic. I would have to go back and look. I think that
two-thirds.
Actually, yeah, there's data on that.
Became
but I wouldn't be necessarily in a rush. You know, I'd talk to her about it, and I wouldn't want to switch her too early, give her an AI, which wouldn't be effective if she still had some residual ovarian function.
I should say the reason I don't check is because I don't think it's true that estradiol and DNRH don't signature menopausal status. So as opposed to saying that I would switch her, I wouldn't consider switching her, no matter what her levels would be.
So you're saying you don't want to switch her?
I don't want to switch her because we don't know what her chances are of being postmenopausal. If you get an estradiol GnRH analog that tells you what she's doing today, not going to tell you what she's doing next week or the week after that. If you have someone who's sexually active and menstruating and you're giving them an aromatase inhibitor, which is an egg stimulant, and unless you talk to her about barrier contraception, running the risk of not only pregnancy, but multiple kind of pregnancy in addition to having ineffective therapy. So one of these GYN organizations, they're just completing this floating through a series of 3,000 women through perimenopause. Now for the first time to try to describe it a little better, they're trying to come up with guidelines of when you can call somebody postmenopausal if they don't meet the criterion of 12 months of no menstruation. For instance, somebody who's had a hysterectomy and you don't know whether they had the ovaries out. And with the average age being around 51 in the United States for becoming postmenopausal, that's 50-50, right? And so that organization says they will call somebody postmenopausal only if they meet these other criteria and they're 54 years of age. And so I don't think the numbers are on my side, even with doing estradiol or GnRH analogs, until somebody gets to be 54. If this patient were 54, then I would be willing to switch them, but I haven't switched anybody before 54. So it's interesting. I think there's probably a lot of people that are being switched early, and it's a little unclear what the consequences of that kind of would be. That's but the only group that I'm really enthusiastic about tamoxifen in for a while.
What about suppressing her ovaries or taking them out?
The other side of the coin is, even though there's phase 2 trials, and Bob Carlson has the one just recently with 50-some patients in it, it's not clear to me how well or completely you're suppressing ovarian function with Zoladex, even monthly. So I wouldn't be wanting to give Zoladex in an adjuvant setting plus aromatase inhibitor. It's very difficult to get the gynecologist in our institution to do an oophorectomy in somebody who's not BRCA1/2 positive. In that setting, then we would have some action. So if I can't convince the gynecologist to take the ovaries out, then I wouldn't use Zoladex like a Arimidex or AI combination. If I did get the ovaries out, that certainly, to me, would be a reasonable combination.
You know, the SOFT trial is allowing ovarian suppression with an LHRH agonist.
Yeah, I know. And I wouldn't do it.
I thought Bob Carlson was showing that they do have excellent suppression of their ovaries monthly.
See, I think what happens is the way the levels are measured, it's just now switching gears. We did a trial trying to look at risk factors for prostate cancer with patients for androgen suppression on Lupron. We were taking people on androgen suppression in the community who had low PSAs and looking at cardiac risk factors, you know, a bunch of intermediate markers. And it turned out that 26 of the people that we had entered on the trial from the community didn't have suppressed testosterone levels. And so I'm just concerned that every 3 months, Zoladex couldn't get an indication for breast cancer therapy because it couldn't suppress estrogen for 3 months. I just need pretty good data to know that I'm not giving something that's not only be effective, but put people at risk of kind of pregnancy risk.
You want to present a case, MJ?
Sure. This is, again, you know, on a different subject, not too complicated. 53-year-old African-American female felt a lump in the right breast in July of 2005, had a mammogram which showed a 2.5-centimeter abnormality in the upper outer quadrant of her right breast, which was suspicious, had a core biopsy in August of 2005, which shows moderately differentiated infiltrating ductal carcinoma, negative for ER, PR, and HER2. And her staging workup was negative. She had a lumpectomy and sentinel lymph node biopsy. Final path actually showed 4-centimeter grade 3 infiltrating ductal carcinoma. Again, triple negative, margins were negative, and her MGA scan showed excellent ejection fraction. Past medical history, she has had THBSO for dysfunctional uterine bleeding 1 year prior to that. She had a remote history and questionable history of sarcoidosis, and her only medication was Lipitor. So we saw her at that juncture, and the dilemma was what to give her.
Her nodal status?
Negative.
So she has a 4-centimeter node negative, triple negative tumor.
Yes.
Mara?
Which is high grade.
If she came to us, I would offer her participation in our pilot feasibility trial of the dose-dense AC Abraxane with bevacizumab, because I think that she would be a good person. There isn't anybody you feel is high risk. And that's a pilot study that we're doing in collaboration with UCSF and Hope Rugo, where it's a straight phase 2 study that everybody gets treatment and the primary endpoint is cardiac safety.
And how long does the bevacizumab continue?
For 12 months. So wow. It's 16 weeks of chemotherapy, and then the bevacizumab is given every 3 weeks at the end of chemotherapy to complete 1 year of treatment.
What has been observed, first of all, in terms of the dose-dense Abraxane? See much difference between that and Taxol?
It's still early, and then we're still accruing patients, and we're almost at 50, and it's been about 6 months. So not that many people have actually finished the Abraxane portion, so I don't yet have a clear sense of that.
And if she weren't eligible for the study or didn't want to participate, what do you think you would have done?
I would do dose-dense ACT.
Rowan?
I think everybody feels we need something different in this population, but we're kind of lacking data. Just in terms of ethnicity, is she Caucasian or
African-American?
Kind of interesting finding that we had in Women's Health Initiative, again, in General National Cancer Institute 2005, when we looked at risk factors for breast cancer and the African-Americans doing worse. And it really was interesting. In that large population, we showed that African-Americans were at half the risk of developing receptor-positive cancers compared to Caucasians when we adjusted for GALE factors and about 10 additional factors. But they were at 4.7-fold greater risk, almost 5 times greater risk of having triple-negative cancers, equivalent to triple-negative cancers, ER-negative, PR-negative, and high-grade. So it really is kind of amazing, and at risk for early death then as well.
Any explanation about the triple-negative?
Well, I think the idea is that Lisa Carey at North Carolina ended up in, I guess it was
JAMA.
JAMA, yes, yeah. Signaturing that they had gene profiles that looked to be kind of basaloid cancer, and there was 2 or 3 abstracts, now everybody looking at their populations and finding these triple negatives very commonly in African Americans.
But I mean, is there a difference in a triple negative tumor in an African American and in a Caucasian person?
Well, no one's seen that yet.
It's more common.
Yeah, and it is interesting where, you know, kind of BRCA1's triple negatives, you know, commonly. And so our hypothesis going in is in that 2005 paper, we said, well, maybe there was genetic isolation in African populations as well, as opposed to being Jewish populations in Europe. But here you have to be close to the water if you're in the desert or you're not in the jungle, and so basically there might have been less transfer than there would be walking through Europe when you just go to the next country over the hill. So it's interesting. So there may have been some selection pressure one way or another to result in mutations that result in fewer tumors but more of these worse tumors. And of course, that could explain why you are at a higher stage of diagnosis because they're growing faster and worse outcome because they're less. And so that's not to minimize the importance of screening and all that in that population, but it really was kind of not politically ideal to be able to have these findings because it would be easier to think that it was all related to access.
So bottom line, what do you think you would have done for this patient?
Yeah, I would treat the patients. It depends on what your standard high-risk regimen would be. This is, she's 53 years old, right? Mm-hmm. 53 years old. HER2 negative, and she's young enough, and so we probably would give her TAC times 6. As I look around, it looks like there's a lot more TAC on the West Coast, and there's a lot more dose dense on the East Coast, and probably the transmitter of both of those signals runs out of the Mississippi River, I think, someplace. You know, you get a transition zone in Kansas, I think.
That's interesting. You know, we do these patterns of care studies, and clearly dose dense is the most common regimen used, the node positive, much more commonly than TAC or AC, followed by docetaxel. We wanted to look at that regionally because we had sort of a sense also, certainly in the New York area, dose dense is extremely commonly utilized. What did you end up doing with this patient?
Well, we offered her a clinical trial as well, a SWOG study of metronomic chemotherapy. She declined that, and our usual discussion with the high-risk patients, we don't really believe in node-positive, node-negative being the risk paradigm that we follow, and she clearly was high-risk despite negative nodes. So we talked to her about our usual high-risk regimens, TAC or AC followed by Taxotere or dose-dense in that order with de-emphasis on dose-dense because of our biases, and she chose to receive AC followed by Taxotere.
And what was the reason she didn't want to go on the study? The study, I guess, is looking at a couple of questions. There's sort of a dose-dense component and then this metronomic component.
Yeah, the dose-dense component at the end is paclitaxel. But before that, they get daily oral cyclophosphamide and weekly doxorubicin.
Right, that's in one arm or one part of the first part. Why did she not want to go in that study?
She just wasn't comfortable with randomization.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Did ECOG 1199 have any impact on your use of Taxol versus Taxotere?
Not really. Because, you know, when you look at the way that trial was written, weekly docetaxel initially was also to be given without break. And then it was allowed to give it over 15 elapsed weeks or 16 elapsed weeks. In the end, only about 77% of doses of the weekly docetaxel could be delivered. And when we give 100 of docetaxel Q3 weeks, we give it with growth factors, which wasn't necessarily required in 1199. So there are differences in how it's actually done in practice now vis-a-vis how the trial was done.
But you know, there was equal efficacy.
There was equal efficacy in the end, taking into account how it was delivered. So if you believe that full doses could be delivered in everybody, maybe the efficacy would not have been equal. The other is that weekly paclitaxel is definitely more neurotoxic. And these women live forever. And I personally take neurotoxicity very seriously. And I don't want somebody's hands and feet to be significantly numb for a number of years. So that's why we are averse to picking weekly paclitaxel as a default regimen.
How did this woman do?
She's NED still. I mean,
so how does she tolerate therapy?
She tolerated this therapy just fine. If we have to pick a weekly taxane based on the preliminary evidence that we have so far with nab-paclitaxel, although, I mean, it's a young drug in our experience, I'm actually intrigued by how weekly nab-paclitaxel is less neurotoxic than Q3-week nab-paclitaxel, but that's the opposite for traditional cremophore-based Taxol.
Did MA21 have any impact on how you view dose-dense treatment?
Again, not, because the cycles were imbalanced, the doses of cyclophosphamides were imbalanced. I mean, there were so many confounding variables in that to me it was not a dose-dense trial.
Maybe extending that discussion of that trial is very interesting, isn't it? Because without the dose-dense part, if you look at the AC to Taxol part...
Can you review what that said?
Yeah, so MA21 was a Canadian trial looking at CEF, classical CEF, Cytoxan, PO, day 1 through 14, and day 1, day 8, the other two agents, 5-FU and epirubicin. And then they looked at AC to Taxol straight up, AC 6600, Taxol 175, and then a kind of a dose-dense regimen. That would be the dose-dense, people wouldn't describe it as dose-dense, I think. But it was an every 2 week epirubicin Cytoxan regimen, then followed by a taxane on a 3 week schedule. And the surprising factor, I think, to many of us was that CEF beat AC to Taxol, I mean, pretty badly. I mean, recurrence was 90 versus 85. And the numbers are there. There's a spread of the numbers that make it a believable result. The dose-dense, in quotes, trial was very similar to the CEF. I think a surprise to many of us, because Europeans have been saying for a while, taxanes aren't that great, and CEF is pretty good. And for it to beat it is really something. And no matter what the regimens are, that really is our usual criterion before is you get one chance to get beat with the regimen. And once you're beat, then you're pretty much out. I mean, that's the way it's been working. I mean, basically, you don't get another chance. It's like the NCAA tournament. You know, you lose and you're out. So I could beat somebody else. So that raises some interesting points, because AC to Taxol is a comparator in some of these existing trials. And if you beat it and you have something that's, you know, already beaten, and then something very similar, which was the EC to Taxol 90 of epirubicin in the other trial, beat by the sequential dose dense. So you had two things that beat the equivalent of AC to Taxol, and that was with the survival benefit. Either Adria at 60 or epirubicin at 90 as part of an AC to Taxol 175 regimen looks like it's beatable, right? Because it got beat twice. So the question is, what do we do with that? And just as the most provocative thing you could possibly say, I think, would be we don't have a breakdown by receptor status, and we don't know about dose dense and receptor positive versus negative, right? I mean, we're waiting. Right, on that.
For which study? MA21?
No, MA21.
Actually
for
really
Citron
showed,
study, we have it.
Yeah, in MA21, they really showed that the differences are in the ER negative population in particular, which I think is really fascinating.
Yes.
Again, sort of showing that, you know, chemotherapy is most beneficial in that population and how much it adds to ER positive. It didn't matter what chemotherapy you got if you were ER positive, the outcome was the same. I thought that was the most interesting slide.
Which brings us again to the Berry JAMA paper that any manipulation of chemo was meaningless in ER positive.
Right.
I think that there can be a lot of debate about which taxane and which regimen, which schedule, but the preponderance of evidence is about 175 of Taxol Q3 week being the most inferior of all taxane regimens in any setting. In the metastatic setting, it had been beaten by Taxotere with nab-paclitaxel. In the neoadjuvant therapy, it has been beaten by weekly paclitaxel. It's been beaten by weekly paclitaxel in metastatic as well as neoadjuvant setting. And in the adjuvant setting, you're saying after four cycles of AC, it has been beaten by dose-dense, and it has now been beaten by classic FAC. So I think that at least should now be clear that in breast cancer, 175 of paclitaxel Q3 weeks is a decidedly inferior taxane regimen.
You want to present a case, Mara?
Sure. Again, with the theme of patients and clinical trials, I saw a 40-year-old premenopausal patient who came to me initially for neoadjuvant chemotherapy for inflammatory breast cancer. And she had a core biopsy of the breast that confirmed cancer, and clinically she had the diagnosis of inflammatory cancer, and it was ERPR positive, but also HER2 positive with a staining intensity of 3+, and she was FISH amplified. And I did an EOD evaluation, and she had lymph node, bone, and lung metastases. And she's still menstruating with HER2 positive metastatic disease.
Anything else you want to say about her in terms of her living situation?
She is at home full-time with her 3 young children. She has like a 4-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 10-year-old. And she has an interesting family history with her sister, who was diagnosed with colorectal cancer at age 40, had adjuvant chemotherapy, and is now NED. And her mother had had breast cancer, diagnosed at age 41, and died of her disease at age 44.
Any symptoms from the tumor?
Yeah, she had a painful, tender breast, and she had left axillary lymphadenopathy that was also tender.
How about the mets? Any symptoms?
She probably has some mild rib pain, but that's it.
How would you have thought through this, MJ?
Well, again, very aggressive disease in a young patient. So here's a patient opposite to the comments I made earlier on another patient where I would like to be aggressive rather than just sprinkling something and seeing what happens. So here I would have used a combination, and because she's HER2 positive, it has been clearly shown that if Herceptin is not part of initial management in a HER2 positive patient with chemo, then we don't catch up with survival from the pivotal Sleiman paper. So if I am to give Herceptin, it will have to be with chemotherapy. The next question is, will it be with single-agent chemotherapy or combination? And the only real trial that showed benefit of triplet therapy with Nicrobair, Taxol, Carbo, Herceptin versus Taxol, Herceptin, although it wasn't powered and didn't really show a survival benefit, it did show benefit in time to progression, which can also be important. So I would be tempted to talk to her about that triplet therapy. Otherwise,
just on that point, any thoughts about the paper presented at ASCO last year, kind of looking at the same thing?
Are you talking about TCH versus TH with Taxotere?
Right.
There were issues, I think, with that trial. Again, I'm very sensitive to confounding variables. So there was Taxotere was at 100 with Herceptin, and it was at 75 when Carbo was added. Unlike Robert, where dose of Taxol was the same in both arms, and there is a dose response curve in Taxotere and metastatic disease shown, you know, 60 versus 75 versus 100, at least for response rates. So I think that was one difference. The other was that it was an overambitious trial which attempted to show a 50% improvement, which was too lofty a goal. So it fell short of that and became a negative trial. It could not show a 50% improvement. So I think those are the two reasons or criticisms that I would have of that study.
So you think you would have given her TCH?
I would have talked to her about TCH, and if we wanted to go just with single agent, again, that's my personal bias because we were very happy with our results of phase 2 nevilbine, trastuzumab, then I would have gone with nevilbine to at least spare her the alopecia and steroids and neurotoxicity.
And what about hormones?
Not concurrently, but once you get the disease under control for maintenance, then the question would have been, would you continue trastuzumab? Of course, yes. Would you just continue trastuzumab or add hormones at that time? She's premenopausal and we have no evidence with tamoxifen trastuzumab. But if she was postmenopausal after chemo, we render her postmenopausal by ovarian ablation, then the results of tandem trial showed that anastrozole plus trastuzumab had at least double the time to progression compared to anastrozole alone.
Rowan, how would you have thought through this case?
Pretty similarly. I think it's hard to interpret those two combination trials because the Taxotere 100 is a kind of deliverable regimen with Herceptin. You'd say, I can handle that. I agree the statistical issues, but it looks like an attractive regimen. And then that would be one thing. And we had given that to a number of patients, but TCH would be just as competitive. And then as a first line therapy. And afterwards, this woman, for a variety of reasons, probably would be going for genetic counseling just in terms of the whole family kind of situation. It may well be that she's going to need her, whether it's important for her, it wouldn't take too much to get her ovaries out and then be able to convert her into somebody that you can give some of these other therapies to. She's pretty clearly through with childbearing at this point, too, I think, in terms of her family intentions. So I would have a very similar approach.
But would there be any point in taking her ovaries out with metastatic disease?
Well, I think the idea is that easier.
It's
just such an easy procedure for the gynecologist to do it compared to coming back and forth for Lupron. So in other words,
if you want to suppress, thought you were talking about from a preventive of her family history.
I was thinking that this might be somebody that I could get our gynecologist to take the ovaries out, but I think it'd be a lot easier to take the ovaries out than to give Zoladex monthly for a prolonged period of time.
Got it. So what did you end up doing?
So she was offered participation in our clinical trial of a nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel plus carboplatin plus Herceptin, a phase 2 study. And Andy Seidman is just what you guys were saying, with Abraxane instead of docetaxel or paclitaxel. And she actually did extremely well with that. She had a partial response. She had complete normalization of the breasts, the left axillary, no tranq, and she had a reduction in the pain. And she did have an unusual reaction to carboplatin. And, you know, with carboplatin, you can get some hypersensitivity reactions, and it was unclear, so that ultimately was discontinued. She continued on Abraxane and
Herceptin.
She developed intense pain during the infusion in her lower extremities and some flushing, and I wasn't there at the time, and the person who saw her really was unclear, but it was during the infusion, and it was several infusions into it, and the hypersensitivity reactions are most common in 6 to 8 infusions into carboplatin, but I think are more classical with throat tightening and shortness of breath, but she had some sort of unusual, unexplained reaction, so it was stopped, and she did well. Well, for a time, and then we treated till maximal response and then began ovarian suppression and letrozole.
Where is she right now?
She's had a couple of lines of treatment now. She has had fulvestrant as well as ovarian suppression because she did okay for a while on both hormonal therapies. And then she was placed on another clinical trial looking at an apophyllone, the Bristol Myers BMS.
Exabepilone.
Thank you, exabepilone. I can never remember the number. But she was on the exabepilone Herceptin phase 2 study and also did very well on that. So really reintroduction of microtubule stabilizer. But she had significant neuropathy on that, and she had already had a lot of Abraxane.
Did she have a neuropathy with the Abraxane?
Yes, she did. And then it got worse on the exabepilone.
Did it go away once you stopped the Abraxane, and how long?
It got better, yes. I don't know exactly how quickly it got better in the sense, but she had disabling neuropathy with the exabepilone and was stopped and also got better. And that's, I think, when I gave her the fulvestrant. And then she's most recently been on vinorelbine plus Herceptin. And she's about to participate in another clinical trial of irinotecan plus 17-AHG, which is a HSP90 inhibitor.
So maybe we could have some comments about these investigational regimens. And here's one that is getting some use in the community. And that's the one that Mark Pegram reported on, the trastuzumab and bevacizumab combination. 37 patients with this 54% response, first line, previously untreated with Herceptin, but with 6 out of 37 people having some cardiac kind of issues. And it's interesting to me watching Los Angeles, because there is some of this use in the community of that regimen on the basis of even before the phase 2 partial report was there. And so that's variously looked at as a promising monoclonal antibody interaction is a big response, or as a disappointing response, and that shouldn't cause anybody to do anything or be very excited about. So I would be interested in other people's views of it. I was kind of moderate to it. I said, you know.
Is that a regimen you would consider or have used in a non-protocol setting?
No, I haven't. When I saw the data, I wasn't very impressed with it, but other people have been, and I'd be interested in the other panelists' comments about it.
I think it's an exciting combination, but I think it remains investigational. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to get a better sense of the potential for cardiac toxicity, and I would like to see more patients treated and get a better sense of the safety. I think there was just one person who had grade 4 CHF, but there were some other events. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that it does increase cardiac toxicity, but I'm not using it outside of a clinical trial. But I am interested in combining anti-VEGF and anti-HER2 therapy, and we are about to open a study of bevacizumab in combination with lapatinib at Sloan Kettering, also in collaboration with Hope Rugo at UCSF.
With chemo?
No, it's just the two drugs, anti-HER2 and anti-VEGF.
MJ, any comments?
Along the same lines, I think it is exciting, and we have to realize the excitement is because of the conceptual quantum leaps that we think we are making in oncology rather than the response rate. I mean, you can think of a dozen doublets that can produce a 54% response rate. It's just that these are biological therapies. They are new, and there was no chemo use in this trial. So this is the first time we have seen, without an ounce of chemo, seeing this type of response.
But as Rowan said, this was their first exposure to trastuzumab. If you look at Chuck Vogel, I mean, the response rates, I think, were much lower.
It was 26% with Melody Coble. So there is incremental response.
But, you know, it's a single institution phase two trial. You know, it's hard to know really what that means.
It is looked at differently as interesting signal by some people are saying, you know, I expected more. Or so it's like, watch this space, I guess, then. Not for use at home at the present time.